The next matter on our calendar is the case of Shear v. Harpstead. Council, you will each have 15 minutes for your oral argument. The appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Will there be any splitting of the time for the argument between council? All right, very good. Just please identify yourself prior to beginning your oral argument and let us know who you represent. And with that being said, the appellant, please take your time. If you need to further prepare, please do so.
May it please the court. My name is Sam Orbovich. With me is Pari Magera. We're from the law firm Frederickson & Byron. We're here on part of our firm's pro bono initiative, and we represent Brighter Home Healthcare and its owner, Zaina Shire, and Family Care Transportation and its owner, Abdi Ahmed. With us today in the gallery is Zaina Shire. The question presented is whether the district court erred by dismissing our complaint for failure to state a claim under Rule 1202. Procedural posture is we're seeking declaratory judgment injunctive relief, and the court granted the motion to dismiss filed by the Commissioner of the Department of Human Services. The relief that we request is that this court reverse and remand with directions regarding what level of due process DHS must afford when DHS imposes a suspension based on an allegation of fraud. The standard of review, whether the complaint sets forth a legally sufficient claim for relief under the cases that we've cited in the brief, including the LZ case, allegations of constitutional infirmities deserve a judicial forum, and defendant must demonstrate that our complaint is frivolous in order to have it dismissed.
All right, are you claiming the statute's unconstitutional as written?
Your Honor, we're claiming that the statute is unconstitutional as applied.
As applied, okay.
The facts of this.
And what part of the statute? I mean, there's a number of statutes involved here. Specifically, what statute are you claiming is unconstitutional as applied?
The the state statute is Minnesota Statutes 256B.064, and the subdivision that allows a temporary suspension upon a credible allegation of fraud.
Let's begin with that if we can. So the first thing in your due process argument is to identify the interest, right?
Yes.
In order to determine what process is due.
Correct.
And I just want to try and focus in on that first, if I could. In your brief at page 10, you talk about at least two constitutionally protected interests. The first one is a reputational interest because the MCOs were informed
Yes.
of the suspension. Let's leave that aside for a moment and pretend that the provider didn't work with MCOs. So that was a non-issue in a case, okay? So there was no notice to MCOs. Then the second interest you identify as being deprived of the opportunity to pursue the occupation of one's choice.
Yes.
Okay. So that's what I want to focus on for a moment. Is it your assertion then that at the moment of temporary suspension upon a credible allegation pursuant to the statute, on day one of that, there is a protected property interest in the ability to pursue occupation of choice?
Yes.
And what's the authority for that property interest, I assume you think it is? I don't know. But what's the authority that there is one at the start of a temporary suspension?
This is a matter of first impression. Okay. No Minnesota appellate court has determined whether or not there's any process that is due in a suspension situation for credible allegation of fraud, when the department finds a credible allegation of fraud. So we don't have any case law out of Minnesota on, directly on point. But we rely heavily on the Fosselman case, which we've cited, and which I wrote the friend of the court brief on the constitutional issues a number of years ago. In Fosselman, not only was the reputational interest, the liberty interest protected, but Fosselman said that the relators, in that case, two registered nurses and a QMRP, a qualified mental retardation professional, as the term was used back then, that the relators, quote, clearly have a property interest in working in direct care positions, unquote. Property interest in their work. Now, the defendant and the district court.
And that was the final determination on licensure with respect to them working with clients who were, right?
Yes.
So don't you have an uphill climb? Is there not case law that's contrary to your position that, in fact, a temporary suspension upon an allegation of fraud is not, that there's not a property interest at that time?
All of the cases relied upon by the defendant, all the cases relied on by the district court with respect to temporary suspensions are distinguishable. For example, Arecibo, Clorinda, and Midwest Family, the three key suspension cases relied on in the court below, are Medicare cases, not Medicaid. And the reason that that's important is that under the Medicare regulations, 42 CFR section 405.372D1, temporary suspension is defined as not lasting any longer than 180 days. We don't have that in this state. We don't have that level of definition. So
when does the interest arise then? If it doesn't arise, so I understand your argument there, and it seems like there's 180 under Medicare. If there's 180 days, I suppose after that 180 days, does it arise? But here you're saying it arises on day one because there's no 180-day requirement to complete
it. Well, understand, and I will admit that my complaint is not as clear or as concise as it perhaps could have been. But the relief that the appellants are looking for here is that there be a probable cause determination on whether or not the state can show that there's a reasonable possibility that my client committed fraud.
Is that required in the Medicare situation you described?
No, it's not. But the Medicare situation is not going to last forever. It's certainly not going to last 2 years, as this suspension has. And in evaluating due process, it's flexible. You have to evaluate the risk of harm. You have to evaluate the burden. And where the department has imposed a so-called temporary suspension that has no end in sight, I would submit to you that there has to be at least some guardrails put on the department.
Can I just stop you there? Because, you know, as I read your brief, you think that this should all go to the district court, and the district court should decide whether there's probable cause, as if it were a criminal matter. I assume. Is that your argument?
No, it's not, Your Honor. Let me just refine it a little bit.
Okay.
In some of the other cases that were cited below, the reason they're different is because that's exactly what happened. In Guzman, Peterson, and Kindheart, the disqualification case, there had already been a finding of probable cause because a criminal proceeding started before the suspension or disqualification. What we're looking for is one of two things. Either the reinstatement of what we call the Kerber rule, which was the department's first policy, which reserved credible allegation of fraud suspensions until and unless there was a finding of probable cause in a criminal proceeding. That's number one. But short of that, if there is no criminal proceeding, at some point, the department should have to have a Bell v. Burson-type probable cause hearing where they at least come forward with sufficient evidence to demonstrate that there's a reasonable possibility to believe that my clients committed fraud.
Well, could I stop
yes.
again? Because I mean, none of this, what you're requesting, is in the statute. Am I
That's correct.
And what is in the statute is that in order to suspend it, there has to be some kind of credible information that they have that there may be fraud.
That is true. However, the same thing is true in Fosselman.
Okay, but can I stop you again?
Sure.
Because I'm not done. But in order, the statute also provides that in order to contest that or to take issue with that, your client can come forward with documents and information, you know, that says, no, this is not correct.
That same.
I mean, doesn't that give your client that ability allowed under the statute, give your client, even at that initial stage, to provide some due process there? Because they can provide that information.
It's not sufficient due process, and here's the reason why.
Okay.
The exact same right, submitting more information, was also afforded to the Fosselman defendants who lost, or relators who lost their job. And this court found that it was not a sufficient level of process. You know, I have clients in these fields, and I've been litigating against the Department of Human Services and the Department of Health for 40 years. If the Department of Human Services issues a $1,000 fine, my clients are afforded a full contested case proceeding under the Administrative Procedure Act. If the Department of Human Services issues a temporary immediate suspension of a licensed provider, and these providers are not licensed, within 5 days, they have to, I think it's 5 days, under 245A-07-08, they are required to initiate an emergency-type immediate contested case to determine the exact kind of things that Bell v. Burson requires. Is there enough information? If somebody is accused of maltreatment, they get a human services judge full hearing. If somebody is disqualified, they also get a human services judge hearing. This is a situation where there are unbridled, no guardrails, where somebody within the department can end businesses based on an unreviewed determination of probable cause, determination of fraud.
All right. Well, one point that the respondents make over and over again is that there is no protected property right in the continuation of Medicaid benefits.
Yes. In the words of folks saying,
it's a voluntary program, and
right.
and that this doesn't affect their, I mean, their business. They can keep doing their business. So they just won't be able to get the Medicaid support.
Well, honest, there's a folk singer named Jackson Brown, and he has a song that says, "Do not confront me with my failures, I remember them." Over and over again in this court or in the state, in the federal court, I have attempted to suggest that there's a property rate in Medicaid, property right in Medicaid rates. There is not, but you don't need to reach that determination. This court has, on one occasion, in the Good Neighbor case, said that a pre-approved rate that is being reduced, Judge Lansing said, that is a property right. But that's not the property right that's really implicated here. The property right is the ending of the business, the ending of the contracts with the clients.
Except when there's a suspension given, and I think your complaint seems to indicate that the minute that suspension is a notice of that suspension is given, that the business has to end. And is that necessarily true?
Yes.
And why would that be true? I mean, they're not saying you can't do a business. They're just saying we're not going to be providing any Medicaid benefits.
Well, as you know, we didn't have discovery down below. We didn't, you know, this was just our complaint, and allegations have to be taken as true, and the allegations include the fact that the impact of this was to end these businesses, cause people to lose their employment, and force clients elsewhere. The Department of Human Services requires these folks to Zaina's company and Abdi's company to transfer their clients to other organizations. They tell the other payors so they lose their business. The PCA Choice Program is a purely Medicaid program. There isn't a commensurate or similar private pay aspect to that delivery of services like there would be in a nursing home where you'd have private paying patients and Medicaid patients. But the simple fact is that when the federal law was enacted and with these robust considerations, the department had a prudent, thoughtful mechanism for dealing with this. We call it the Kerber rule. They weren't going to impose this until somebody outside of the department.
But that wasn't a promulgated rule, right?
It wasn't a promulgated rule, but...
And it was only in effect for during the time Mr. Kerber was in...
It was in effect for 4 years at least, which is longer than the period of time in the Coco Crown case that the 1.5 years was insufficient to say that it was longstanding. But also, under our Administrative Procedure Act, if a rule exists, whether it's promulgated or not, to repeal it, there has to be another rule. And that's what they didn't do. Your Honor, I just think this is a slippery slope. There's too much unchecked power with the Department of Human Services. William O. Douglas said, the Constitution is designed to keep government off the backs of people. And there needs to be some guardrails here, just as there were in Fosselman. Thank you.
Thank you. And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Brandon Basie, Assistant Attorney General, on behalf of the Commissioner of Human Services. Also with me at council table is Scott Ikeda, Assistant Attorney General. Your Honors, this case is about a business that had a single stream of revenue consisting of taxpayer dollars that were temporarily suspended because it was determined that credible allegations of fraud existed against those businesses.
Okay. Can I stop you right there? Because the main argument they're making is how is 19 months a temporary suspension?
Your Honor, the statute does not provide a specific time frame of how long a suspension may or may not last.
But this can go on for years?
Your Honor,
I just don't know how. I mean, what does the statute provide for the department to do in this case? I mean, can you just sit on it, just temporarily suspend? That's an easy way to deal with this issue, and then the people just never get paid and they go out of business.
Your Honor, what the statute states is that when DHS determines that there's a credible allegation of fraud, it must refer the case to the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, which is a separate, distinct entity that's the prosecuting unit. The statute then states that the temporary payment withhold will only continue so long as an investigation is pending or the commissioner determines that there is no longer a credible allegation of fraud. And so as long as there's an investigation pending, I think what Your Honor's question gets at to is what check is there over DHS? And what the check over DHS is the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. If they determine that there's no longer a investigation pending, they can let DHS know that, and the payment withhold would have to be lifted. What appellant's asking this court today is to say that when a fraud investigation is extremely complex, when a fraud investigation takes a lot of time, those fraud investigations we should just let go and be able to pay them as they continue. Fraud investigations are a complex thing, and so it seems to be backwards to say that if the fraud is so prevalent or complex that it might take a number of years to investigate, that's the type of fraud that we want to keep paying individuals there's a credible allegation of fraud against.
So what do we have in the record that this is a particularly complex fraud case?
Your Honor, there isn't anything in the record at this point. It was a motion to dismiss, and so the point that the commissioner is making is that there isn't a time frame in the statute for a reason. And the reason is because this isn't a one-size-fits-all. Investigations aren't something that can fit into a box that we can just put a date and time on the investigations. And I think, you know,
I ask you this, because I'm sorry I interrupted, but, you know, if the party that is subject to the suspension wants to bring it to a head and says, enough already, it's been 19 months, would they be able to do something in terms of bringing it to a head within the administrative process?
Your Honor,
I would think that would be a natural response to this. If they truly think they didn't do anything wrong, they said, we want our day in court.
Your Honor, it's the commissioner's position that there isn't a cause of action as far as a due process claim that they could bring. You know, I don't know.
Is there an administrative claim?
Is there an administrative claim?
There isn't an administrative process other than they are permitted to challenge the temporary payment withhold by submitting evidence and say these are not actually credible allegations of fraud.
If there's continued dispute after they submit their evidence as provided for in the statute, couldn't they bring a request for a contested case proceeding?
I don't believe
it. To a head?
I don't believe.
Do they just have to sit and wait for however long it takes for the department or the attorney general to do something?
I don't believe that there is a contested case proceeding available to them. I don't want to foreclose the idea. I don't want to speak as to what the merits of such a claim would be. But if the plaintiff believed that an agency or a entity was not doing a non-discretionary duty that they're required to do under the law, mandamus is a option that's available to them. If they didn't believe that an entity was doing the proper investigation or that they didn't believe that was a discretionary duty was being done, there are remedies available.
So I want to get to the, I mean, to me, here's my, I want to understand your understanding of the federal and the state law and how it relates to Medicaid fraud. I mean, I thought about that mandamus. I'm not sure who you think it would be against. I suppose the commissioner is the one whose action they're challenging, but it seems like the commissioner is deferring entirely to the Medicaid fraud unit and almost seems to think or take the position, and maybe it's accurate, I want you to explain it, that their hands are tied until there is such a decision. And I just want to understand, so the way the state law says that the withholding will not continue after the commissioner determines there's insufficient evidence of fraud by the vendor or the legal proceedings are completed. Okay, so it's the commissioner's determination whether there's insufficient evidence of fraud. When I'm looking at, and no one's cited to this, I don't think, but that's why I want to make sure I understand it. When we look at the federal rules, 455.23, a commissioner makes the initial determination of credible allegation of fraud. It's true the commissioner must make the referral. And then the suspension under the federal law continues until the agency or the prosecuting authorities determine that there's insufficient evidence of fraud. So it doesn't require that it be the prosecuting authorities. It says the agency or. And then it goes on to talk about if the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit accepts the fraud referral, the suspension continues. On a quarterly basis, the state must request certification from the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, et cetera. And then if the Medicaid Fraud Unit declines, then it's up to the agency to lift the suspension or find an alternative basis for it. And, of course, there's also a good cause provision that the state can decide not to temporarily suspend. So it just strikes me that, two things, that commissioner is not beholden to the Medicaid Fraud Unit entirely. There's maze in the statute, federal rule rather, and there's good cause provision. And then also, what about this request for quarterly certification? How does that fit in here?
Your Honor, what I can say to your question, I think you're right in the sense that the statute does allow the commissioner, if the commissioner had some reason to believe that their initial credible allegation of fraud was incorrect, whether that was from Mifuku informing them that they were no longer investigating or whether it was a determination that the facts that they were relying on were incorrect, I think that there is a way for the commissioner to say that they're lifting the payment withhold. But I know that the CSRS division at DHS, when they refer cases to Mifuku, they receive the quarterly reports from them as required by the statute. And so, but there isn't any allegation in this case. There isn't any facts in this case that indicates that the commissioner should have done something different than the commissioner has done. And I think, you know, what Your Honor, with respect, I think what's being missed, maybe not being missed, because I think the court had pointed it out, but the commissioner's payment withholds in this case did not shut down a business. Nothing in the payment withhold stated that they had to stop serving their clients. Nothing in the payment withhold stated that they had to close down their business.
But that's sort of, I mean, to the extent that something temporary is de facto permanent, if there were a permanent, you may no longer do business, that would be entitled to some due process, right? So it's not just the question that you choose to do some publicly supported business, because that would be true of the people in Fosselman and nurses, et cetera. Like, you could do only private pay, but there's still due process when you're permanently excluded, right?
Your Honor, with respect to Medicaid payments, there is a hearing that's provided by statute. The case law has been pretty clear that there is no property interest, due predicate property interest in the receipt of Medicaid funds. And so you're correct that if there was a final suspension or there was a final notice of clawing back funds or a fine or some kind of thing for a fraudulent act,
a disqualification,
there would be a hearing provided by statute for the individual to challenge that. In this case, Your Honor, the case law is very clear. We've cited a number of cases, not just from plaintiff's counsel is correct that this court hasn't ever decided this particular issue, but the Eighth Circuit has decided this issue, the Fifth Circuit has decided this issue, the Ninth Circuit has decided this issue, the Second Circuit has decided this issue. Plaintiff has not cited a single court decision that has looked at this issue and said that a temporary suspension of Medicaid payments violates the due process clause.
Have all those circuit courts decided Medicaid?
They have not all decided Medicaid. The plaintiff is correct that some were Medicare.
So what about the 180 days? Does that factor into whether there's an interest?
Your Honor, I'm glad you asked the question, because the 180 days, if you read the CFR that was cited by plaintiff, the 180 days explicitly does not apply to payment withholds that are implemented when there's a credible allegation of fraud in the Medicaid or the Medicare Act. There are two separate provisions in subsection A of that CFR. And one is, I don't remember the exact language, but there's one provision where the 180 days does apply to. There's a separate provision that the 180 days does not apply to, and that's regarding credible allegations of fraud. There is one of the...
Medicare looks like Medicaid with respect to credible allegations of fraud.
Correct. There is, the respondent would acknowledge that one of the cases that was cited did discuss the 180 days in the Medicare Act and discussed a time frame there with 180 days as far as Medicare. The other cases that were with respect to Medicare, the Clarinda case, for example, and the Arecibo case did not refer to any 180-day time frame. There was not, none of the cases were predicated on the fact that there is some kind of time that makes this unconstitutional. And in fact, the personal care products case out of the Fifth Circuit, Your Honor, again, reiterated the fact that what this court has found, what the Eighth Circuit has found, that there is just not a protected property interest in the receipt of Medicaid funds. And without a protected property interest, regardless of whether it's a one-year suspension, a six-month suspension, a two-year suspension, a temporary suspension, there isn't a right to relief under the Due Process Clause.
And I'm sorry, maybe you've answered this, but with respect to permanent disqualification, is there a due process, except property interest, or are you just saying there just is a statutory protection, or would you agree that there's a property interest?
I wouldn't agree that there's a property interest, Your Honor. I think that this court's been very clear that there isn't a property interest in the receipt of Medicaid funds, but I would acknowledge that there is a statutory right to a hearing.
So even if you've provided the services, like I think is alleged here, let's say you even are a big provider and you've provided, you know, $500,000 worth of services and those get permanently, you are not entitled to that, there's no property interest in that.
If it's based on I don't think there's any allegation or any case law that would say that they would be entitled to payments due that were the subject of a fraud investigation. I think, Your Honor, what's important to understand.
I'm talking about a finding there was fraud. We're not going to pay you the half $1 million that you of services you did because they're fraudulent. There's no property interest in that.
Not under the case law that this court has stated, as well as other case law, Your Honor. But I think it's important to understand is that property interests are not something that are found in the U.S. Constitution. The U.S. Supreme Court has been very clear that property interests are created by statute or created by some other type of articulated right.
Right. And so, I would just think there's a statute that says if you perform services, you get paid for them. And so,
correct, Your Honor. That might be the case. I guess it's not the question presented in this case, Your Honor. The question presented is whether a temporary suspension violates the due process. And this court has been very clear as far as a protected property interest that just is not a interest with regard to Medicaid funds.
What about a liberty interest? Do they have a liberty interest in their reputation?
Your Honor, the liberty interest issue in this case, assuming that a liberty interest was properly raised in the district court, and we've covered that in our briefing, I won't cover it today, but assuming that the liberty interest is properly before the court, Your Honor, liberty interests require, a damage to reputation requires something more than just mere defamation. That requires some kind of specific action by the state. In this case, Your Honor, the appellant is arguing that third parties did something in response to a statement by the state, and we've cited case law in our brief that's very clear that third-party actions are not the scope of a due process violation for reputational damages. The U.S. Supreme Court and other federal courts have been very clear that there's a difference between state law defamation and something that arises something higher to a liberty interest as far as the reputation is concerned. And so I think, Your Honor, the commissioners covered that pretty sufficiently in their brief and they'll rely on their briefing.
Can I ask you, you indicated that if there was a determination by the department that there was fraud and a request for sanctions or reimbursement, that could be contested under, I assume that would be under 256B.0643, is that correct?
I believe that's the statute. I don't have the precise statute.
In other words, it's a vendor request for contested.
Correct.
Okay, so that could be done. Do you think that a vendor in this case where there's nothing happening and they want to bring it to a head, and could they request a contested case proceeding in order to bring it to a head?
Your Honor, I can't speak for how the department would respond to that type of request. I don't think that that's something that's contemplated by the statute, so I don't know if it would be something that they would provide, but I can't speak to how the department would respond to such a request.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
There is no mechanism for the appellants in this case to bring this to a head other than filing an action in district court to try to obtain some form of relief, which is exactly what we did.
Well, can I ask you, is there anything in your complaint that indicates that your client, pursuant to the statute, provided information with regard to the claimed fraudulent matters?
Yes. We attached 3 or 4 complaint exhibits. Complaint exhibit B as in boy was filed by a law firm on behalf of Zana Shire and Brighter Home, pointing out that the department's suspension was based on facts that had nothing to do with either Zana Shire or Brighter Home. It had to do with facts involving a different company owned by her ex-husband. He put affidavits together to indicate that the ex-husband had no interest in Ms. Shire's current business, and it was improper for the department to just assume because her ex-husband might be a fraudster that she was a fraudster. That went nowhere. I sat down with the inspector general and 3 or 4 people with the Department of Human Services 3 months before I filed this action and discussed matters with them. It didn't change their mind. the importance that Medicare regulations, and not Medicaid regulations, but Medicare regulations have a 180-day time frame, just as Judge Smith pointed out. All of those cases evaluated what process was due, knowing that in 180 days, somebody was going to make a decision. In the 19 months since these first suspensions, this court has issued over 4,000 opinions. We have seen 3 commissioners of human services and 2 attorney generals. And they can't get around to making a determination of whether or not there's a chargeable offense for these 2 folks. They are abusing the temporary suspension power and ending these businesses so they don't have to deal with them.
Can I ask you this? I mean, there's one thing. I can understand there's a referral to the Attorney General for the criminal matter, but couldn't the department on its own make a determination that, based on what's been submitted here, we think there's fraud, and therefore we think that we're going to exercise our rights, which is they can do sanctions, they can do. Claim for reimbursement, then you get it into the contested case hearing before OIH.
Absolutely, right? Your Honor. And if you ask the question, could we ask for a contested case now? We can't. Why? Because under the Administrative Procedure Act, you can only contest a final order by the department. We don't have one. We're twisting in a regulatory purgatory for years.
Counsel, is mandamus a possible remedy then?
No, because there's no final order to demand that we have a contested case. And mandamus is...
Well, mandamus says you have to give us a final order, that you can't, that temporary means temporary, and at some point it's no longer temporary, which is the very argument you've made to us.
Sure. And my assessment when I decided to proceed with a declaratory judgment injunctive relief was that I thought that there needed to be enough determination by a court that the department was doing this incorrectly, and that it was not a clear legal duty. I mean, the statute says it's a temporary suspension and it doesn't have a deadline on it. If I were in a Medicare situation and we were in 181 days and they hadn't made a decision, I think that would be a clear legal duty that would be appropriate for mandamus. But here we've got too much ambiguity, and there's just, you know, my concern is...
So the problem is with the statute.
The problem is with the statute, but it could be corrected by doing the exact same thing that the problem with the statute in Fosselman did. And Your Honor, you were on the Fosselman bench. I don't know. But in Fosselman, the statute did not provide for a hearing. That's what they were resting their position on. This court said that's an error of law because the Constitution requires a hearing if somebody's liberty interests or property interests are at stake. The same remedies appropriate here. In complaint paragraph 44, I show the chart that the department brags about where they are imposing so much enforcement action against PCA agencies. Fine. But think what would happen in a different time period with different people running the show. If a Planned Parenthood organization did 0.0196 error rate, and they called it fraud, they'd be able to shut them down immediately. This is a slippery slope, and it's the exact kind of slippery slope that Justices Chudich and Justices Anderson warned us about in their kind heart concurring and dissenting opinion. Thank you.
Can I ask you one more question? Because as I'm hearing your argument, it's the non... There's no limit as to how much time the temporary suspension can last.
Correct.
That's your biggest complaint.
Biggest complaint is that they have converted what a rule says is a temporary suspension into a permanent suspension. And the district court saw that. If you look at the transcript of the oral argument that Mr. Basie and I had in the district court, the district court asked some questions similar to this bench. How long is it going to take you to get this done? I don't think they were assuming that we'd be all the way up to the Court of Appeals and still not have a decision whereby There's no prosecution, and we'd be in an administrative context. And by the way, the statutes that cited don't allow the commissioner to defer to the Minnesota Attorney General's office on this issue.
Is there anything prohibiting the commissioner from doing both? Refer it over for criminal prosecution and proceed with your sanctions and request for reimbursement? Is there anything stopping
the commissioner could issue
simultaneously?
The commissioner could issue an appealable administrative order claiming that my clients have been overpaid, which my clients would then have a right to appeal to a contested case proceeding. They don't need to hang people out in suspense, but they're doing it because they're abusing the temporary suspension law. Thank you.
All right, thank you.